Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Vixed Baking Company, the first banana-based vegan baking mixes. Learn more at vixedbakingcompany.com. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here, and we are going to hop right into some quick announcements. We have two events next weekend that you'll want to mark down if you're here in the Twin Cities. The first is Women Ventures Women Mean Business Luncheon on Friday, October 11th at the Minneapolis Convention Center. I'm so excited for the keynote speaker. It's singer Jerilyn Steele, which should be great. And then after the lunch is the Marketplace. So we will be there in the Marketplace alongside about 40 other woman-owned businesses, including our friends over at Lollydale Socks. And then on Saturday, October 12th, you'll definitely want to check out the Twin Cities Book Festival, which is held at the State Fairgrounds, sponsored by Rain Taxi. This is going to be such a great event. Not only will Feminist Book Club have a booth, but you'll also get a chance to hear today's guest, Carly Moore, speak. The lineup is incredible, so check it out. I hope to see you there. Be sure to stop by and say hello. Links to both of these events are in the show notes. Our final announcement isn't about an event, rather a giveaway. We're currently running a giveaway over on Instagram with our friends from Fabulously Feminist. They have started a subscription service for all their artwork, and they're giving away the September and October items, and then we're throwing in one of our October Feminist Book Club boxes as well. So to enter, all you need to do is go find that post on the Feminist Book Club account, give it a like, be sure you're following both our Instagram account and the Fabulously Feminist Instagram account, and then we will contact the winner on Wednesday, October 9th. So head on over to Instagram there. We'll put that in the show notes as well. Can you believe it's already time to start talking about our November box? What? Our members are currently voting on which book we'll be reading, but there are some fabulous options on the list, such as Thick by Tressie McMillan Cottom, Know My Name by Chanel Miller, and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents by Julia Alvarez. We'll announce the book of the month next week, but what I can tell you about November's box is that every subscriber will receive a bag of vegan baking mix from Vixed Baking Company. I love everything about this company. The owner, Farouk Niaz, decided she wanted dessert, but nothing nearby could accommodate her vegan diet. So instead of driving miles for a subpar restaurant, she decided to just whip something up with the ingredients immediately available to her. So that's flour, sugar, and some overripe bananas. I always have overripe bananas sitting on my counter. That banana saved Farouk from what would otherwise been a pretty boring dessert. And that's what inspired Vixed Baking Company. She now packages those. All you have to do is add a couple bananas and you have muffins or bread or something fabulous that you will create. You'll receive your Feminist Book Club box with plenty of time to whip up some vegan muffins to appease your holiday guests. And trust me, your vegan cousin will be so grateful for a Thanksgiving dessert that she can enjoy. Go check out this company at vixedbakingcompany.com or on Instagram, which is at vixedbco. And that's Vixed, which is vegan plus mixed, if you get it, V-I-X-E-D. And if you want to be on the list to get a November box, head to feministbookclub.com and use code podcast when you check out. Now, today's interview, so good. Carly Moore and I discuss a wide range of topics, including Occupy Wall Street and what it meant to her and what it means to these characters, resistance, character development, and the craft of writing, and so much more. So I hope you enjoy. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I am speaking with Carly Moore. Carly is an essayist, novelist, and poet. She's a queer single mom, Vans lover, and hashtag cat wife. Love it. The Not Wives is her first novel. In 2018, Tinderbox Editions published her debut collection of essays called 16 Pills. In 2017, she published her first poetry chapbook called Portal Poem. And in 2012, she published a young adult novel, The Stalker Chronicles. She lives in New York City with her kid and cat and teaches at NYU and Bard College. Welcome, Carly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk about this book. I think it's so interesting and so necessary and so timely. But to start us off, I always ask, what is your definition of feminism?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I have a really simple definition, which I use with my students a lot too, but just if you believe that people of all genders should have equal access to services and pay and equality in general in their lives, then you believe in feminism.
Amen. It should be that simple, right?
That's really not complicated.
So then how does that simple definition inform your writing work?
Well, I think that my writing is feminist in a bunch of different ways, but I think in terms of essays, I've been teaching the essay and writing essays for a long time. And so essays, I write a lot of personal essays, although I bring a lot of text into them. So, the old second wave mantra of the personal is political, that's very important to me. Although, I'm aware that the personal doesn't always become political and you have to actually work to connect yourself to larger political movements. But that's one way in which my writing is political. And then in terms of fiction, I think that I just really care about complicated women. Queer people, children, like any characters that are potentially marginalized, I want to sort of bring into the mainstream in my books. And also the way that I write about sex is, for me, very feminist. Like, I really try to write sex positive, kinky, erotic, real sex.
Yeah, the more romantic scenes in here were pretty hot.
I'm so glad, because I wanted to capture the hotness of sex, especially for a middle-aged mom character, because you often don't get to see that. And I also just, also awkwardness and funniness, sometimes sex is awkward and funny and sometimes terrible and sometimes hot. I just wanted to get at all of that.
Yeah, super effective. So I want to read the blurb about this book before we dive into it to kind of set the scene, because there's a lot that goes on that I think it would just be better if we just read it. So the blurb on the back: The Not Wives traces the lives of three women as they navigate the Occupy Wall Street movement, a gentrifying city, and one another. Stevie is a non-tenured professor and mom in the middle of a divorce. Her best friend Mel is a bartender torn between her long-term girlfriend and her desire to explore polyamory. And Joanna is a homeless teenager trying to find her way in the world, who bears shared witness to a tragedy that interlaces her life with Stevie's. Together, they build a new American identity of resistance. So we've got these three characters set in this backdrop of Occupy Wall Street. Why did you choose that movement?
Well, I think, like many Americans and especially New Yorkers, I was really taken by Occupy Wall Street, and I wasn't able to stay overnight because I had a small child at the time and I have a disability, so that made it tricky. But I went often with friends, with my husband at the time, now my ex and good friend. And yeah, it was a really, for me, someone who's always been interested in activism and teaches about activism, it was a very utopian space, though it had problems, of course, as all utopian spaces do. But I like occupation as a political act. And I think, you can see its effectiveness in places like Hong Kong right now and all over the world. But Occupy was really special in that it changed the conversation around debt, I think, in this country. A lot of people say that Occupy was a failure, but I don't think so at all. I think it helped us have the kinds of economic conversations we're having. It was also fun to go, and there was the People's Kitchen, and they were feeding so many people. They were taking care of homeless people, which eventually sort of overwhelmed them. There was the library, there were kids there were parents there were teachers there, all these unions came together. And the General Assembly meetings were really special too, because they, you know, invented, I think, or maybe they didn't invent it, but they really made it popular, the people's mic. So, you know, one person calls out and other people respond. And I really was moved by participating in that. It really changed the nature of, you know, voices and who got to be heard, I thought.
Yeah, I was living in Chicago at the time when Occupy was happening. And even though that was a big city, we still, and we had our own Occupy, it still felt distant.
Yeah.
So reading this book, it just brought it into vivid color for me that I wasn't aware of all of the ins and outs. I could read the news, I could watch the, but the news is its own lens, right? Yeah. And so I was really grateful for this very personal depiction of what that movement really felt like. And I see now how personal it was for you too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to claim to be one of the occupiers, and I was lucky to make friends with an occupier later who helped me with research, and I read some books too. But I think a lot of people had a personal connection to it in that they were going and sometimes marching. You know, every day almost there was some kind of march to the bull or some movement, and those little marches were very empowering too, I think.
Did you decide to write this because of your experience there, or was it kind of the other way around? Like you were writing a book and then decided to set it in this movement?
I'm trying to remember. I think when I started working on the book, you know, I think I started working on it a couple of years after, but I was pretty sure from the outset that I wanted characters to go there, and I wanted to be, that seemed like a really good site for people to sort of keep interacting, because it's displacement from their regular lives and also allows them to sort of push against these ideas about who they're supposed to be. So yeah, I think I started with Occupy as the setting. I started with Occupy and then the protagonist, Stevie. Later, that, in the first draft of the book, it was really just her story, although Mel and Johanna were in the book, but in a later revision, I really sort of fleshed out those characters and they got their own arcs.
So that was going to be another one of my questions about the characters themselves. How did you develop them? And I hear a lot of Stevie in you and you in Stevie. So I'm assuming she's a little more personal to you. But what about just the character development?
There are definitely parts of myself in Stevie, and she is probably the most like me, although we are also different. And she certainly becomes her own fictionalized character. And then Mel is also loosely based on a good friend, but again, sort of transforms into somebody else. So then there are composites of people I know in other characters. Johanna is just, she's not someone I know well, but she's a person that I see in the city all the time that I've always really been interested in. I mean, a lot of the book is about, you know, homelessness and fears of homelessness and gentrification, and the city has all, I think all cities have these, you know, youngish 20-something or late teens, sometimes queer, sometimes not, struggling homeless kids, often with a pit bull on a rope. And I've always just really wanted to like make them central to something.
Yeah, I really liked Johanna's character. I felt like there was a tension with her that she seemed to me a runaway.
Yeah.
And fairly privileged, but choosing to live a more transient life.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of those kids with pit bulls are making a sort of summer choice. I think she's privileged in her whiteness and her sense of self and mobility, and she's quite brave. No, brave's not the right word, but she's tough.
Yeah.
And
incredibly smart too.
And really smart. So she has all that going for her. Yeah, I think she's different than, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, homeless LGBTQ kids who are on the street and pushed into sex work, although she is also sort of choosing that as well. Yeah, I love her And she's the biggest invention of the book, I think.
Yeah. There is a lot of, I said at the beginning, there's a lot that happens in this book, a lot that goes into this book, and you cover a lot of territory using these three characters as avenues or vehicles to explore big themes like homelessness, like sex work, like different paths to motherhood and gentrification and things like this. But it all works. Like that's, that was the thing.
I'm glad. I mean, I worked very hard on pulling it all together, and it was really a challenge. I'm glad it's working for you.
Yeah. So it could be, on paper, it sounds like it could be super messy, but because these three characters are so well formed, you just get a realistic depiction of what day-to-day life looks like for them with all of these. I mean, we all struggle with these things. Yeah. That it just, I think it was really successful, and I commend you for it. It's really sharp writing.
Thank you. Yeah, I did it. You know, it had probably 6 or 7 revisions, and it went through a really major revision before it found a home with Feminist Press and with Amethyst Editions. Yeah, there were times where I really felt like, oh, I can't control all the parts. But it worked out.
Yeah. So I'm curious about those revisions because I love talking about the writing process. Mm-hmm. You mentioned briefly that it was first just told from Stevie's perspective.
Yeah, it was first all first person, all Stevie's voice. It always had the little chapters of wives and not wives and husbands. So that was there from the beginning. Mal and Johanna were there, but they were much more, because it was first person, they were very much in through Stevie's eyes.
I was gonna say, and what made you decide to bring in their voices?
Well, I mean, publishing is so complicated and such a twisted route often. And, you know, this is not even my first debut novel. I have a whole other book that went all around and didn't find a home, which is very typical for writers, I think. But I had an editor at a big five publishing house who was really interested. And so I was working with my agent, and my agent had sent it all around. And this editor said, you know, if you can do these other two storylines, like we will take this book, we will acquire it. And in the end, and I did that. And I think it made it a much better book. It took me like 8 months to do that. It was a really huge revision. And then for reasons I will probably never know, they were not able to acquire it, which was super sad and made me very sad for a while.
I can imagine.
And then we started to move towards small presses, which was great. And I felt just so happy that Michelle T at Amethyst and Feminist Press wanted it. So the revision was really pushed by the very smart editing of this woman. And I'm really grateful for her giving me these notes, but it was really hard. And then it was a real kind of emotional whoosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the Feminist Press. I think the work that they churn out is incredible.
Yeah, me too. They're so well respected, and they have such a great history, and everyone that works there is so lovely and smart.
Yeah, everybody I've interacted with there has just been delightful.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that the little snippets, the not wives and the wives and the not husbands and husbands, were part of the first version. I loved those sections because they read like poetry, and I know you're a poet, and they were so confusing in a good way that you were just kind of like, what is this? And I like that in a book. Tell me about those sections. Tell me about the title, because I think that's part of the whole conversation here, and what do you think that brings to the story?
Yeah, I love writing those sections. Those are my favorite sections to write.
Can you explain them a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, so they're really kind of repeating lists of, it'll say the wives, and then, you know, the wives are doing this and the wives are doing that, and some of the wives are at SoulCycle, and some of the wives are fixing a salad, and some of the wives are I'm doing a bad paraphrase of my own writing, but some of the wives are worried that their children will be shot, and they sort of really go between the mundane and the, I try to make them go between the mundane and the, you know, less mundane and political, but I really just, I've spent a lot of time on playgrounds, and I've spent a lot of time around wives and husbands and parents, and now not wives and not husbands, and I really just wanted to capture the kind of buzz I think that we have in our heads around like people's roles and cultural ideas about wives in particular, and also just the language that women use about themselves especially. But I kind of don't know where, so I think that's what happened, but I also don't know where they came from. They just started to come out of me like a trance state, and I just kept writing them because they were so, they just needed to come out. Like I felt as I was sort of pulling stuff was just flying out.
Did you know, why did you choose to put them where you did in the book?
I think I had, I mean, I had less of them in the beginning, and then, and we, the original title of the book was not The Not Wives. It was Gold Star. And it was, confusing for many reasons, but I was really trying to get at this, like the idea of being the good woman, the good mother, the good at everything and getting a gold star. And then I think my agent moved us towards the new title. I'm pretty sure it was her, Jess Salke, who's amazing, or it might've been a conversation with her and Lauren Hook at Feminist Press, but we moved towards that. And then I added more of those sections. And then we just tried to have them kind of throughout so that you could kind of check back in. And I also think of them as little resting places where you can just kind of lose your mind a little bit.
In a good way, yeah.
Like, I don't know, I've loved poetry because it's just, I like the sections because I think they give you a little narrative break.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's almost a bit of editorializing.
Yeah, and they do also like make these bigger claims, mm-hmm. and help the novel be about these larger things, I think in a hopefully like trickier way.
Yeah. So when I was introduced to this book, I didn't know what the not wives meant.
Yeah, no, because it doesn't exist.
So tell me about the title.
I was just now in that last question, I was sort of trying to remember me or Jess or Lauren. Maybe, I don't know which one of us came up with it or if we came up with it collectively. Or maybe I think I did one day. Maybe it was me. It was, I think it was, but I definitely had help. We were like throwing around a bunch of potential titles because Gold Star was, it wasn't working. I don't think anybody, it didn't really resonate for people. I think at first it was The Not Wife, and then when Mel, but yeah, I think I was just trying to play on the fairy tale type of thing, like, but yeah, the not wife doesn't exist, but now she does, maybe.
Yeah, so she's a woman that is not a wife. I mean, that's, it's simple. Yeah,
it comes out of one of those it actually comes out of, you know, she's talking to one of her lovers and she says, you know, that's the great thing about me because I'm not a wife. I don't actually have to do those things anymore. And that really came out of my own experience of transitioning from being in a straight marriage and separating and getting a divorce and coming out as queer. Like, I just felt a huge lifting off of me of all of these wifely duties that I really was never very good at and never really wanted. So I really wanted to have a character who would just push against all of these things that I think women get trapped into, or just we end up doing because we're wives, but you know, half the time, or your former wives, and then you're like, what am I doing? I don't even care about this.
Yeah, it speaks to those roles that we feel pressured to participate in. I fail as a wife every single day.
Yeah, I mean, what does it even mean to be a wife? You know, I it's such a complicated thing. What does it mean to be a husband? I mean, I think, and in queer relationships too, you know, two wives can get, you know, tangled in, you know, there's just these unconscious things that we do, I think, from parents and from the world around us that, you know, I think we all need to resist.
I'm glad you brought in the queer aspect of that too, because Mel gives us such a great insight into what being a wife to a woman or a not wife to a woman or femme partner looks like. And I want to talk a little bit about that relationship because I found it so compelling, and especially in terms of polyamory and then also motherhood.
Yeah.
Would you expand a little bit about Mel as a character and then her relationship?
Yeah. So Mel is bisexual or pansexual, and like many bi pan women I know, actually men too, but gets some shit from it about it from her partner, who's a lesbian. And I think that's pretty common. I think it's becoming less common in younger people. But I have experienced a lot of that from, oh, you're not really gay, or, oh, you're not gay enough, or, you know, you're definitely not Gold Star and you're a traitor because you suck so much dick. So I think there's that tension in their relationship, but they also recognize, and I know so many couples who are trying to do this and some have done it really successfully. And I've also been poly in certain parts of my life and still really believe in it as something that's worth exploring, not always successfully, but where am I going? So Mel and Jenny are really trying to figure out like how to stay in their relationship, but have other partners, and how to be each other's primary partner, but also like acknowledge like that they want to have other lovers. And I think it goes like many openings up of when people open up their relationship, it goes in different ways than they imagined. Like Mel didn't, I don't want to give too much away, but
yeah,
it ends up being surprising.
Yeah.
The way that it goes.
Yeah. And it works. It works out.
It does.
And I really appreciate that there are moments where they're in therapy to discuss the opening of the relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really hard. I mean, I think people do it without therapy all the time, but there's an idea, you know, that you're just cheating or that you're just doing whatever. And it's actually, if you're doing an open relationship in a conscientious way, it's actually really about a lot of communication. And it's actually harder, I think, in some ways than monogamous relationships. So that's been my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you need help. Like I needed to read The Ethical Slut, and I needed Tristan Taramino, and, you know, I needed a lot of help.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about resistance, because the blurb on the back does say that the characters build a new American identity of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
What does resistance mean to you, and how do we resist?
Well, I think about this a lot. I teach this class called Youth in Revolt, and I've been teaching it for 10 years. And so what is resistance is something we think about all the time. And I think about a lot. I mean, I think anybody who's kind of a feminist right now is thinking about like, oh my God, what do we do right now? So, I mean, there's capital R resistance, which is like, you know, occupations, and I don't even want to capitalize in lowercase, but I just will because it's easier. The things that people sort of recognize as resistant, like marching in the streets, like taking over government buildings, occupations, you know, trying to legislate for change. So I think those are the big resistances, and there's so much of that going on in this country right now, although it's frustrating the way that the people are responding in the government. And then there's like the smaller resistances, which are just the things you choose to do in your daily life. Like, I'm going to be a sex positive slut, and that's a form of resistance because the world is telling me that I can't actually have control of my body. Like, that's very important to me. Or, you know, there are so many women of color who I think very, really rightfully are like, I'm going to practice some deep self-care now because I'm tired of dealing with your shit. Mm-hmm. So those are the smaller resistances, but I think are really important. And in the book, it's also about like new queer families and sort of rethinking what family is. And, you know, dismantling these sort of patriarchal notions of like, what a woman should do and how she should care for herself.
Mm. The book is written in these I don't want to say like short snippets, but the chapters themselves are fairly short, which honestly I appreciate as a reader.
I love long chapters too, but I really think it's fun to read a really zippy book.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the choice there?
Sorry.
I was going to say, what is, why did you choose to do that? And what do you think it affords the book and the storytelling?
I mean, it's a bit of a, you know, I don't think it's too long of a book, although my dream for my own work, Suffering, is my next book. I want it to be 200 pages. We'll see if I succeed. So it's a 300 pager. So I wanted people to be able to really zip through. And I think the shorter chapters, you know, if you're not a big reader or you're not always reading, when I was younger, I still find it comforting to just look ahead and be like, oh, I'll be on the next chapter soon. So I like that. And I just like a really tight scene. So I just wanted to, you know, keep things moving. I've had to learn a lot about plot because I went to school for poetry, but not fiction. So it was my way of keeping myself moving as a writer.
Yeah.
Those short chapters.
I'm reminded of, gosh, I had a professor in my PhD program, my very first class, who had these guidelines of how to write. And one of his phrases was to write economically, and all of your words count for something. So don't add any fluff.
Yeah. Was that useful for you on the first day? I mean, I feel like
it was horrifying. I hated it.
Yeah. I would never, I mean, you know, I'm a writing professor too. And I never like say that right away because it's just, you know, you have to actually make a big mess before you can cut things. Like there are 50,000 words of the Not Wives that are just cut.
Right, right.
So I couldn't write economically right away. Mm-hmm. I had to cut a lot.
Yeah, I was a very wordy writer. I still am. I ignored a lot of his rules for good reason.
I'm such a difficult teacher. I'm always like, no, that won't work. I just don't like to scare people in the beginning. Like, that's just scary.
Well, there's a reason I dropped out of that program.
I had a whole PhD program that I left also. I mean, I went into another one and was very happy, but
yeah,
it's hard to leave when you're getting bad teaching.
Yeah, there was a lot of reasons, but yeah, PhD dropout, recognized PhD dropout. But well, can't believe we're out of time already. So I asked just a couple questions to wrap us up. If you have a book recommendation that's not your own that our listeners should check out, what do you recommend?
Oh, I'm reading so much right now. I just finished Patsy by Nicole Dennis Benn, which I think is just extraordinary.
I've heard such good things about that.
I would totally recommend that. I'm also reading, I have to go, I'm going to my bookshelf. I'm reading The Memory Police with my students by Yoko Ogawa. She's a Japanese writer, and that's amazing. And I have so many. Oh, The Yellow House by Sarah Broom, which is getting a ton of attention. One of the most beautiful memoirs I've ever read about growing up in East New Orleans and like housing and gentrification and being African-American in this country.
Sound excellent. We will link all of those in the show notes. I also, but before I forget, we talked about this before we started recording, so I forgot to mention it, but you will be here in the Twin Cities for the Twin Cities Book Festival in October.
Yes, I'll be there.
And so I'm so excited. Feminist Book Club will be there as well. So,
okay, so we'll meet in person there.
Absolutely. So for our listeners, if you're in the Twin Cities region, it's such a great event. Come check us out. Come see Carly speak. Come stop by the Feminist Book Club booth and, you know, bring a few tote bags because you're going to want to buy all of the books.
Yeah, there's amazing people coming. I'm going to meet some of my heroes. I'm so excited.
Who are you excited about?
Lewis Hyde, who wrote The Gift.
Yeah, excellent.
The Gift is like such a transformative book. So yeah, that's one person.
Yeah.
Many others, but I'll just name him for now.
So if we want to connect with you further online before or after that event, where can we find you?
So I'm on Twitter at CarlyMoore2. I'm on Instagram, Fragmented Sky. And I'm also on Facebook, Carly Moore. And I'm pretty active on all of those sites.
Excellent. We will link those in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for this. This is, we're recording on a Sunday morning. We're both looking like we're at, it's a Sunday morning. Exactly. And so I really appreciate that. And everybody go snag a copy of this book. It is transformative. It is excellent. It is a great read and you will learn a lot.
Thank you, Renee. Thank you for caring about my book.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature, A well-read woman is a dangerous creature,
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.